Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Men's Monday here on Mind Talk. Every Monday, we talk to a different man who is graciously willing to share with us his goals, his views, what his life is like. And today is no different. I am very pleased to introduce to you Corey James, who is the founder and CEO of Painting Pictures, which is a nonprofit organization dedicated to making an impact in the lives of disadvantaged youth. Corey James, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thanks for having me, Dr. Pamela. I just wanted to, first of all, just mention that my heating system is making some strange noises in the background, so I do apologize if you do hear something.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that. Speaking of impact, right?
Yeah, absolutely right.
Now, Corey, from what I understand, not only are you the founder and CEO of Painting Pictures, but you also lead a New Jersey State University Future Scholars Program in Newark, New Jersey.
Yes, that is correct. This is a five-year program where our students start as rising eighth graders, and they are with us until 12th grade, and we provide academic enrichment in those 5 years. They're with us biweekly on Saturdays and throughout the summer for 6 weeks. And then those that complete the program successfully and are accepted to the university are given a full tuition scholarship.
That is wonderful, and they start off at the eighth grade.
Yeah, so it's a really, really great advantage for them, especially to learn the necessary skills in order to prepare them for college early. And I think that's really the most important, getting them early rather than waiting till they're in the 11th and 12th grade, when sometimes it's a little harder to prepare them for that great challenge ahead of them.
And you've got them coming in on Saturdays.
Yeah, that's, very difficult, not only for them, but for me. But they are here. And sometimes we have to motivate them, of course, because they're young people and they don't always understand why I'm doing what I do now. But we have to instill in them and remind them that this is for the greater purpose of your future.
That's really extraordinary.
Yeah.
You have devoted actually your life and your career to serving at-risk youth in urban communities.
Absolutely.
Why?
Yeah, honestly, this is not something that I ever thought I would do. When I began this journey about 11 years ago, it was not the journey that I had planned for my life. I had originally started my life and I went to a Christian college and majored in theology and youth ministry. And with that in mind, I planned on being in the church setting and eventually have a thriving church as a pastor. That was my goal. And somewhere along the way, I actually moved to Southern Jersey in order to take a youth pastor job. And because it was a part-time situation, I had to also find some full-time employment. So while there, I started working at a nonprofit organization full-time. In this particular program, I was working with adults who were in some hard economic situations. And there I found out that I did not like that job, and absolutely it was a horrible situation for me, in so much that daily I was seeking other job opportunities. And I had a really awesome supervisor who understood that this wasn't a good fit for me and that I wasn't enjoying this position. And because it was a nonprofit organization with various departments, juvenile justice department opened up a position. And because she saw that I was young and that I had ambition, she thought that I would be a perfect candidate for this position. And immediately I refused. I said, I know I don't like this job, but I'll hate that job even the more, mainly because while, young people were of some interest to me in the church setting, it wasn't something that I was looking to do in the community, because I felt like this demographic of young people was out of my reach. So make a long story short, she finally convinced me to do it. It was better pay. It was in the field. So I was like, okay, let me try this just for a temporary piece, and then I'll eventually find what I really want. I started this job, and while the very first day was very bad, I talk about it in the book. I arrived to my first client's house, and he has a gun, and he's pointing this gun at his father, and they are in a fiery argument. And I believe the argument was because this guy, me, is coming to his home to do intervention, to do strategy, to do mediation, and he didn't want me there. So him and his father were in a fiery argument. I arrived to the home and he's pointing a gun at his father, and so what do I do? I don't know. And after, I guess, being in shock for a while, I figure out, maybe I should mediate, maybe I should do something. So I eventually told the young man to come with me, and we went downstairs outside of his house and we talked for a while. I left him outside, went back inside and talked to his father for a while, and then I brought them together and I was able to mediate the situation. And that day when I left, I felt so good. I felt like I had done the most incredible act of my entire life. And I continued to work with this young man, and I began to realize that I had a niche and that this was truly my purpose, my passion. And as my clientele increased, it was just automatic. Every young person was gravitating to me, even though I don't have the same background that they do.
Well, it's interesting because this was not your experience growing up. So this was
No.
a whole new world for you on many,
Whole new
many
world.
levels.
Yeah. Whole new world. Absolutely. I grew up in a very sheltered environment. I was raised by my grandmother and my great aunt, and my godmother had a lot of influence in my life. So, three motherly figures that really had me sheltered to the point where, I had to be home by the street lights coming on, and if that's the winter time, that's 5 o'clock. So, I really had no opportunity to do a lot in life. Like, literally, I live close to New York City. I didn't go there until I was an adult. I couldn't ride my bike further than one or two blocks from my house. So I didn't know the culture or the trauma that was really happening in our inner city communities. So for me, it was like I'm in a territory that is not for me, that I really can't handle these young people because I know nothing about them. And many times when you see people working in this field, they have been there. They've been incarcerated. They've been in gangs. They've done drugs. And for me, none of that had been the case. So I felt intimidated going in and asked myself the question, how could I ever say anything to them because they won't respect my background?
Well, and it's interesting because that is very often the case. And so for you to walk in essentially a clean slate with
Yeah.
respect to what their experiences were like, so there was something about you personally that really was able to connect, certainly in your first experience with not only with the young man, but also with his dad.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think for me it was more that when I started, the day I started, and anything for me in life, when I start something, I'm going to do the very best I possibly can, whether I like it or not. And for, so many reasons, that day when I went into the situation, it wasn't something that I saw myself doing forever. But because I'm in it, I have to figure out how to make it good. So when I got there, I showed up, and I continue to show up. And that's what our young people most need. A lot of people, rather whether they have the background that the young person has or are similar to me, will sometimes go into the situation and realize that it's too difficult, that these young people are quote unquote lost causes, that they don't have a lot of potential, or that they don't want things themselves. They don't have dreams and aspirations. They don't want to be out of it, which is totally a misconception. And then they walk in and out of their lives, which I believe only creates more wounds. So for me, what has made me most successful is that I continued the race, that I would say. And I continued to support these young people even when, after working with them, they would get incarcerated again. I would continue to show up and support them and show them genuine love. And that's what has, I believe, made me successful in this profession, because I'm just real with these young people and I love them from my heart. Like, and I will tell them that, because oftentimes they don't hear a male role model say, I love you, I appreciate you, I care about you. And sometimes for them in the very beginning, that's a little weird. It's a little strange because they don't know, they haven't heard that. But then they start to see it, because love is what love does, I believe. So then they start to see that I really do truly love them. And because of that, they continue to gravitate. And now I'm in situations where young people are asking for extended service hours and want me to come to their extracurricular activities and their family activities because they see that I'm really in.
That's really, I mean, that just is so important. Tell us about painting pictures. You say very early on in your book, which is also entitled Painting Pictures, that a disease is plaguing our inner city youth and communities. So when I think about a disease and then I think about painting pictures, they don't necessarily seem to fit. So tell us about the connection.
Sure. I mean, so when I say a disease is plaguing our young people and correlating it with painting pictures, the disease is the replication of our young people repeating the same cycles. So the same cycle of incarceration, the same cycle of homicide, the same cycle of high school dropping out and our teen girls becoming pregnant. And this is something that they've seen over and over and over again. So it's not anything new. And because this is their norm, although it is an unfortunate norm, they are repeating this, and it has become a disease in our communities because they are simply only replicating what they see. So when I say painting pictures, I'm trying to help young people not replicate what they have seen, what they have experienced, and the trauma that they go through daily, but to see something else. So one of my greatest acts in the Painting Pictures organization is exposing our young people to something different, not only to different geographic locations, but different people that they would never normally associate with, because it's important for them to understand that where they are is not a dead end. And I've been in way too many group sessions where I'm talking to young people and they will say, well, you know, this is my life. This is the struggle. This is how it's going to end for me. I've had many of my peers that are 15 and 16 that have been killed, that are incarcerated, and that is also my fate. So I want them to understand that that disease does not have to plague them any longer, but they can actually become a successful masterpiece as long as they have people like you and I that will paint pictures for them and help them understand that they have more potential than they know.
You know, it's interesting to think about the sort of the whole mind and the spirit of a child opening up when potentially up until they meet you, they don't necessarily have a sense that anybody does care or that there is a picture to paint, quite frankly. Yeah. And so for you to enter into their lives and then remain in their lives is pretty extraordinary. You tell a story about going to a funeral of a 16-year-old boy. Share that with the audience, if you would.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of my, I guess, most sad days. It had happened February 14, 2014. And I had worked with this young man for some time, and he was one of my, like, sometimes you say you don't have favorites, but this guy was one of my favorites.
Okay.
And we had just talked a couple of days before, and he was talking about, you know, his goals, and he wanted to be a basketball player, and he also loved science, so he was looking into the STEM field, and he was just very, very excited that he was becoming on the right track. And I was excited for him, and I was celebrating him. And there was some gang influence that he had been involved in that he was now seeking to get out. And in one of the chapters of the book, I talk about how sometimes that's a hard thing to do, and it became hard for him because the week before February 14th, February 3rd, he's in the city of Carteret. And my understanding after his death is that he was seeking to get out of the gang, but they would not allow him to do so. And on that day, he was actually shot directly in his head. And so he's now 16 years old, and he is a victim to gun violence. So I show up at the funeral, like I said, on February 14th, and it was an incredible, overwhelming experience from his teachers being there, probably every peer in his school and youth advocates and those that had worked with him throughout the years. And throughout the room, there was a wonderful display of him growing up via pictures. And you see him, you know, becoming from a toddler to an adolescent and just a cute kid. And then the pictures end with a casket, right? And that's the final picture that we see of him. And so I get to the casket to say goodbye to my little brother that I called him. And his mom was there, and I thought it was really strong of her to be able to stand near the casket and say, say goodbye or say hello to all those that were coming to say goodbye to her son. And so I embraced her, and when I embraced her, I thought she could have said a million things. But what she said to me was, "I did not expect this so soon." And that truly devastated me in a way that I've never understood it before. At that point, I had been working in the community, and I had seen unfortunate norms, and I had seen tragedy, and I've seen trauma, but I don't think I've seen it the way I saw it that day, because it came from his mom. So in other words, for me, she was saying that, yeah, my son, he's right here in the casket, and I think I expected this to happen, but I just didn't think it would happen today. I didn't think it would happen right now. And that day I realized that this is an unfortunate norm, again going back to that this is a disease that has plagued our communities. And now not only do our kids think they won't get out, our parents sometimes think that their kids won't get out, and now it's normal for the parent, the mother, to bury their son. And that changed the whole my whole understanding of inner city community youth, and made me, while at first it pulled me back because I was discouraged, but it really propelled me forth to work harder.
You know, it is chilling to hear the mother of a 16-year-old expect her son to die.
Yeah.
But just not at 16.
Yeah.
I mean that's just such a profound, I don't even know what words to put next to that, because it is such a huge awareness, awakening, and for the mother, such a huge thing to just anticipate that you will ultimately bury your child.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I didn't understand it. And the funny thing is, it wasn't that she was a bad person, because that was my immediate thought. Like, oh my gosh, this is such a bad mother. You know, she just doesn't have any hope, doesn't have any, you know, desire for her kid to be successful, and she doesn't have any view. And I really kind of dogged her for a while in my head and talked to some of my friends and family. And then I started to realize that it's not her. It's not that she has a bad parenting is all she knows. And that's when, again, painting pictures comes to my mind, because I'm like, not only do we need to paint pictures for these young people, we need to paint pictures for the communities, for their parents, for our school system, because many times we have the same situation in our school system where I hear parents or teachers and guidance counselors tell the students that they can't go to college, that they don't have, you know, the ambition to do so, that they don't have the potential. So a lot of times what we say to our kids becomes a self-fulfilled prophecy, and then it becomes what we call it.
And then when they go to school, if they're going to school, certainly a lot of times the faculty at a school will say the same thing. You can't make it. You won't do it. You're just going to be what you are, which is not enough in my view. And kids hear that and they absorb it like sponges.
Yeah. Absolutely. Working for Rutgers University in the pre-college program of our scholars, I go into schools oftentimes and I talk to guidance counselors, especially when students are, you know, like MIA, missing in action, and I'll ask them, you know, where are they at? And this particular moment was scary to me, because I asked the guidance counselor, you know, where is this young lady? I haven't seen her in a while. And she's like, why are you here? Like, she can never go to Rutgers University. Why are you seeking this out? And I was like, that's the purpose of our programming, to prepare her to go to a college like Rutgers University. And that's why she needs to be there. And unfortunately, when you speak that kind of language over the lives of our kids, you said it, they believe it, they absorb it, and then they don't care themselves, because who really cares about them?
Right. They make it real for themselves.
Yeah.
Corey, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue our conversation about painting pictures. And I want to start with some really startling statistics that you share in your book. So, folks, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back. Corey, tell that heat to stop.
Yeah, I wish, right?
Okay, folks, we'll be right back.
All right. Thank you.
Corey, we've been talking about inner city children, inner city experiences. So let's be clear. When we say inner city, are we talking about black children, white children? Is race a part of this conversation? What are we talking about?
Yeah, on so many levels, I would say yes. You know, we're talking about our black and brown kids that are really having some hard situations, and many times it's because of their demographic and because of the communities that they live in because of their demographic.
All right. The statistics that you share in painting pictures, are these statistics that are specific to black and brown children, or are these statistics that are specific to all children? You, for example, 63% of youth suicides are from fatherless homes, which is five times the average. That's an amazing figure. Is this black children, white children, all children?
So those stats are just really based upon inner city youth, so all children.
Okay.
Yeah.
All inner city children, 63% of those children who commit suicide are from homes where father is absent, and that is five times the average.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, even looking at this is what we can call a fatherless generation. So many of our young people are just raised by a single parent, being a mother that oftentimes isn't emotionally there either. So you can almost say that they're raising themselves. But the father ingredient is so important for the young person. And in the book, there's a chapter called Missing Ingredients. And in that chapter, I talk about how the father is binding the oil that holds all the ingredients together in a cake. And without that oil, the cake will fall apart. And that's what's happening to our young people because they don't have fathers or father figures or male role models. They don't understand who they are. And I talk about in that chapter about how the father figure, how the male role model gives the young person their name. And oftentimes when I meet these young people, they'll tell me sometimes their street name. And I know young people by the name of Savage and Hard Body and Hard Head, and all of their names are very derogatory. And they'll talk about how they obtain these names. They obtain these names by actually being a savage, by, you know, fighting and beating people up on a consistent level. And they remind me that you don't just get this name overnight. It's consistent behaviors, consistent delinquent behaviors. And they take pride in this because no one else actually gave them a more positive name. And that's when the father comes in, because the father growing up, you'll hear him call his boy a champion or call his girl a princess or call his boy a prince. And these are the names that will continue to walk with this young person throughout their lives because they remember the awesome affirmation that they had from their dad. So when they don't have that affirmation, they'll go and seek other people to give them names. And that's why our young ladies as well become victims to being in relationships with male figures that they actually look up to, and they become abusive, they become molested and raped only because they're looking for a male role model or male figure to give them their name.
You say, and these figures that you share, when you say, for example, 85% of all children who show behavior disorders come from fatherless homes, which is 20 times the average. Are you talking about boys and girls?
Boys and girls, yes.
All right, so yes. You're talking about any child who's growing up in a home where dad is absent, and is that correct?
Yes, correct. Yes.
And if dad is absent and there's no male, positive male figure around, mom's a single parent, so she's got to worry about putting food on the table, keeping a roof over her head, over their head, and trying to be a parent. So a lot of times it's understandable that mom may be present, but not really.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that's why we see a lot of our young people becoming street involved, because they don't have anyone to tell them, you need to be home at 7 p.m. You need to get your academics done. You need to make sure that you're handling your situation, preparing for college, preparing for life. They don't have that in their ear. So many times they do whatever they want to do, and we look at them and we think they didn't turn out well. But in reality, they didn't turn out so bad for being raised by themselves.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
75% of all adolescents in chemical abuse centers come from fatherless homes, which is 10 times the average.
Yeah.
85%, I mean, these figures are astounding. 85% of all children in prison come from fatherless homes, which is 20 times the average. So clearly, the fact of a missing dad is huge in the growth and development of a child.
Yeah. And we don't value it. Like, just overall in society, you know, I talk about in the book how we definitely esteem Mother's Day, and it should be esteemed. But when Father's Day comes around, it's typically just another day. And it's really because fathers have a bad taste sometimes in the minds of our society, in the minds of our young people, because they haven't been there. So we don't really esteem that day. So for many of our young people, a father is different. And actually, one of the young men, I was just featured in an article in Union County News yesterday, and he wrote in the article that when he met me, he didn't like me. I thought that was hilarious. He said I didn't like him because he was strict and he would not allow me to do what I wanted to do. And he says I didn't like him because I had never had a male voice in my life. And he came into my life and was being an authority, and he was giving me discipline that I had never received before. So while I didn't appreciate it then, I learned how to appreciate it and realize how important his voice was for my life.
Let me just ask you something which is slightly off our conversation now, but not really. So many times in single-parent households, there is the tendency for the in-home parent to demonize the out-of-the-home parent.
Yeah.
Or to make sure that that parent doesn't have access to the child. Yeah. You know, and typically it's the mom and the dad is missing, but, you know, in today's world, it can be anybody.
Sure.
What are your thoughts about that aspect of parenting and single household parenting? What's the impact of that on the children?
I think it's huge. I think, number one, that a mother does the child disservice if she doesn't allow him to have a relationship with his father. And of course, that's being mindful that the father is a positive or a semi-positive figure for the young person. If the father is really honestly not positive at all, I wouldn't recommend that, but finding a male role model for him. But I do believe that one thing that our parents need to begin to understand is whether it works out for them or not, they need to maintain relationship for the sake of the child so that they can actually raise a wholesome young person, because both the male and the female are vitally important to the life of the young person.
And when we say young person, we're talking about boys and girls.
Boys and girls, yes. Because I think both boys and girls have a different response to not having a father figure. Boys join gangs and they become drug involved, and then that leads to incarceration simply because they don't have that father figure to tell them that they don't have to do that. Girls will then become promiscuous because they are looking for validation. They're looking to hear that I love you. They just need words that say I care about you, and then they'll do anything with a guy to get that. So they both have different responses, but both of the responses are dangerous for their futures.
And, you know, in fact, boys and girls in that regard, looking for affirmation, looking for someone, anyone to care about them, they're actually not so different from men and women. I think we all, just as human beings, want someone in our lives who says, I care.
Oh, absolutely. I think we all do. I know we all do. And unfortunately, some of our kids have become numb to that and feel like they can't allow themselves to be vulnerable and want someone to care for them. Many times I will meet a young person and they will say things like, "I don't need anybody. You know, I don't need you. I don't need you in my life. I'm good. I can do this by myself." In reality, this is only a defense mechanism because they haven't had people in their lives that say, "I care," that say, "I love you," that have affirmed them, that have encouraged them. So now every person that walks into their lives, they are suspect of that they're really not going to stay. When in reality, you start working with this young person and you're like, "Last month you told me you didn't need me, but now you're calling me every day." You know, so being mindful that they will eventually come to a place where they do realize, "I really do need this, and I need to really let my guard down."
And it's okay to need this. This is not a sign of weakness. This is a sign of humanity.
Yeah, and that takes a while, for a lot of our young people to understand, especially, I will say, our boys, because our boys, we live in a society where they are taught that they have to have a tough demeanor, that they have to be aggressive, that they have to have thick skin, that they can't cry, that they can't say, "I love you." So all of these things have been provided as perceptions for our young people. And now when we see them, we see that tough demeanor, that face that won't crack a smile, a very tough exterior. And what I found out, because honestly, in the beginning, I was very intimidated by all of that. But what I found out, once you get to know these kids, I call them big teddy bears, because they become just goofy. And some of the way I show affection and love for these young people, we'll box a little bit because they need that physical touch element from a man when it comes to just being aggressive, but in a loving way. So I've actually been able to really honestly break some barriers for some young people and help them understand, like, it's okay to show affection to your peers that are whether male or female, and be, not such a tough guy, but like smile sometimes. I'll never forget, just a couple of years ago, some of the toughest kids that I have ever had in my program, I took them to Great Adventure, because sometimes I think that these kids have been places. And, Great Adventure Six Flags is not some extravagant place that, everybody's been there. But they haven't. They haven't had a chance to be a kid. So I took them to Great Adventure, and they were deathly afraid of going on roller coasters and doing anything that would create any kind of risk. So they were like terrified, like ready to cry type terrified. And so anyway, I let them do their own thing, and I went on the roller coasters because I like to do that kind of stuff. And I come back and I catch them on the swings that like a seventh, eighth grader would actually, or not even seventh, eighth grader, but a 7 or 8 8-year-old would actually do just for fun because it has no threatening possibilities. And they are laughing up a storm. They're smiling. And you will think they are like some 5-year-old kids on a swing having fun. And that's another day I realized that when you take these kids outside of their environment where they no longer have to have that tough exterior, they become little kids again. And that's what they need.
And so many children really don't have the experience of being children. You
Sorry.
mentioned the children sort of look like 7 or 6, 7, 8 year olds on the
Yeah.
swings. You give, again, some pretty unnerving statistics in painting pictures of a survey that was done of inner city 7-year-olds.
Yeah.
And with those 7-year-old, I mean, just a baby, 7 years old,
Seven.
75% had heard gunshots, 60% had seen a drug deal, 18% had seen a dead body, and 10% had seen a shooting or a stabbing in the home. And these are 7-year-old babies. So is it any wonder that these children are traumatized so early on and don't necessarily have the tools or the skills to grow up and be anywhere near happy or well-rounded?
They definitely don't. They have been traumatized, just like you said. And I am depicted as a soldier going off to war. And when a soldier goes off to war, he sees things that many eyes could never behold. And he comes home and now he's suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And now, oftentimes, that trauma is actually reenacted, and now he's traumatizing other folk. And I think that's what's happening to our young people. They are experiencing trauma in the war zones of their community, and now they're reenacting this trauma, and it's coming out as delinquent behavior. It's coming out through incarceration and high school dropouts because they are traumatized and they've seen way too much. And I do presentations at schools and I talk about these stats. And at 7 years old, you should be watching some cartoons, maybe, riding your bike, just got off your training wheels. You should totally be doing something absolutely different in life. But these kids are experiencing some things that, in reality, when you look at them at 16 and 17, and sometimes we give up on them, that's when we need to be reminded, like, these kids come from a different place. They don't have the nurture, the encouragement that it takes to grow a healthy plant. So how do we expect that these young people will be these thriving young men, these thriving young women, ready to be college bound when they never had the experiences that would offer them a life of success?
And for a lot of these children in some of these schools, they're terrified in kindergarten, first grade, just about whether or not they can get out of school and be okay, be alive, let alone think about going beyond that to something like college. You make the point that Black children are dying in the streets. It's not new. It's not rare. And in fact, at this point, the news, maybe they pick it up, maybe they don't. But when a child in a suburban neighborhood is harmed, it hits the news quickly. It's there constantly, and there's a tremendous hue and cry. Are you angry about this?
Yeah, I'm angry that it has become normal for our environment. I was on Friday in the Trenton School District, and I was talking to the young people there, and I was like, "Raise your hand if you know a peer that has been killed." Everybody raised their hand. "How many of you know that a kid, a peer that's in juvie right now?" Everybody raised their hand. "How many of you have a family member or a friend of a family member that actually is, dead because of a drug overdose or any of these kind of situations?" Everybody raised their hand. So this has become the norm. So I'm less angry at the newscasters and what they decide to broadcast. I'm more angry at what we have considered to be the norm, and we find it okay, even within our own communities, that this is life, this is what has happened. Because the final question I ask these young people is, "How many of you were shocked when those things happened?" Nobody. And I think we have become so desensitized that when these things happen, they are just regular for us. One of my mentees, and I think I mentioned this in the book, he grows up in a very, very unfortunate situation where he's in hallways and he sees people bleed out, and he will look out of the window sometimes in his apartment building, and he will hear a gunshot. He will hear a car alarm because someone is stealing a car. He'll look out the window and say, "Oh, there's another victim," and then lay his head back down because this is regular. That should not be regular. That should actually cause some really great anxiety and call someone to call 911. But these young people are so desensitized to what's happening that it's like, okay, another day, another person killed. And what I also told these young people is, being in group settings and talking to boys in particular, I'll do highs and lows at the beginning of my meetings and have them say something remarkable about their week and say something that wasn't so remarkable. And almost every week, a young person would say that one of my peers died. One of my peers got shot and was killed. And they'll sometimes say, "But he lived a good long life, 16. He died strong." And I'm like, 16 is not an old age. Like, so many of our young people don't even expect to live to even see the opportunity to enter college. Why? Because 16, 17 to die is a normal.
Corey, I mean, what you're saying is absolutely breathtaking. We're going to take a breath.
Yeah.
And we will be back in just a moment. So, folks, stay where you are. Our conversation will continue. One of the things that we hear about often with pride from various school settings is a zero tolerance policy. But yeah. You suggest that it doesn't seem like you're all that thrilled with the zero tolerance policy. Why not?
Yeah, because I feel like that we will have zero tolerance for these young people but not really understand what they're going through. So we put them out, we expel them from school, we suspend them from school, we send them to detention centers. And in those locations, none of them, those that I have seen, and even alternative schools, will provide them the intervention that they need to get on the right track. And I think that's what we're not doing well with this zero tolerance policy. I think we need to be more informed of the trauma that we've spoke about that our young people are dealing with, and then we can kind of place intervention strategies in place so that we can actually work with them rather than sending them away.
We've been talking a great deal about the problem. Let's take a look at what people who are listening might be able to do. I mean, on some levels, it almost sounds like a daunting, insurmountable task, but you've been able to meet the task and be quite successful. So what works?
What works? I think sticking with it. Just yesterday, I'll give you a situation, because while I'm at the Rutgers Future Scholars Program, I do find myself working harder and longer with the kids that may have defiant behavior issues. And so one of the mentors came to me yesterday and was like, you know what, I'm done with this kid. He's not hearing us. He's continuing to be defiant. He's not working. And I was pretty lit just by hearing that, because I'm like, no, that's what happens to him too often. We have to stick with him. We have to stay with him. And we have to push him and acknowledge to him that he has what it takes. And that's what we need many mentors and supporters and advocates to do for our young people, is just sticking with it. And it's not going to be easy. When you meet a young person, they're going to challenge you. They're going to see how long you're going to stick around, and they'll do that by being disruptive, by being delinquent. So when they actually have these behaviors, honestly, I look at it as a test. You're trying to see if I'm going to stick with you. And that's what our mentors, our adults have to do, just stay the course and make sure that we don't give up on our young people.
That can take a lot of patience, and,
yeah.
And you know, in the midst of sort of trying to navigate through the disruptive behavior, still there need to be rules that are set. There needs to be guidance and boundaries.
Sure.
So again, what do you say to the mentor who says, "I am just so done with this kid. I'm not doing this." What do you say to that mentor?
I say you have to understand where they're coming from. So I always like to look at the situation that the particular kid is in, because every kid is in a different situation. So this particular kid that I was speaking to the mentor about yesterday, I talked about the fact that when we reach out to his home, and first of all, he doesn't have a father figure. He has an older brother that is incarcerated. And then when we reach out to his home, his mom gives us various excuses why he can't attend the program. She actually lies about him being out of town. So she actually is not even a positive support for him either. So when he does come, I'm like, number one, I'm glad he's here. So I'm glad that he's here because there must be something here that drives him to come, because otherwise he honestly does not have to, because he doesn't have any support that would push him here. So he's here for a reason. And is he attention seeking? Absolutely. So we have to find an element to ensure that he does get the attention he needs, but also gets the discipline that he needs. So, for example, we are in classes all day, and in order to work with this young person, you have to accommodate them where they are, because every young person is in a different place in life. So because he will be typically disruptive in class, and he's brilliant, so keep that in mind. He is one of the most intelligent young people I know, but he has some severe behavior issues. So in order to keep him on track, you may have to pull him up and have him be more like an assistant to you. Keep him productive. Keep him feeling like he has some responsibility, that he has something in it, that he has some ownership, and then he actually feels good about himself, because at the end of the day, we spoke about earlier, they want validation, they want affirmation. So when you bring him up to the front and he has the opportunity to be an assistant to you, then that behavior becomes reined in, because now he feels important and superior, and that's what we want our young people to feel.
You know, that's an interesting approach, because I would think that there wouldn't be a whole lot of people who would take a child who was acting out in the way that you describe and decide that this guy had the potential to be more than just a rotten kid, and give that child the opportunity to really shine in the way that that child, that boy or girl, actually can.
Yeah, and that's important, and that's where I believe in teaching teachers and mentors how to deal with this demographic, because they are a different demographic. And if you go into the classroom or you go into organization expecting every kid to be the same, you are going to be in for a rude awakening. But understanding that every young person has a different level of ability, because, for example, if this young person was delinquent in defiant in class, but yet he doesn't have the skills to be up front, maybe that's not the particular task you want to give him, because now he'll be embarrassed because he doesn't possess the pizzazz to be in front of the classroom, the articulation, or maybe he doesn't read well. So you do have to think about their situation, and because this young man is very intelligent, he actually can do it, and he has the charisma to do so as well.
One of the tools that you recommend mentors, adults, and access is listening. Why is that so important?
Hearing our kids out is super important. They don't have a whole lot of people that listen to them. We will preach to them, we'll scream at them, we'll argue with them, but rarely do we listen to them. And much of the frustration that they possess is because no one is listening to them. And I have heard young people say things like, "I don't do what I'm supposed to do because they don't care. I'll say something to them and they'll totally ignore me." So listening to what they have to say, because they have some good opinions, they have some good thoughts, and then they have some thoughts that just need to be refocused. And if we're not listening to them, we can't pull out the good nuggets that they do have and affirm them for what they are saying well, what they are doing well, and then help them kind of get on track based upon some of their good ideals. I often tell people too, when you see a young person maybe a day or a week or a month later, again, repeat something they said to you the last conversation to let them know that you were listening. Because number one, I know I like to be listened to. I think we all like to be listened to. And when we are listened to, it does give us a sense of value, appreciation, and affirmation. So when we can actually just hear our young people out, I believe they will feel like, wow, I'm important to this guy. And because I'm important to this guy, it will actually change my behavior, because now I don't want to disappoint him. And that's one thing that I don't always feel that youth advocates, mentors, teachers understand. When you get these young people on your side and really when they know that you really care about them genuinely, they don't want to disappoint you. So some of these kids that are most at risk, that are most defiant in class, when I show up in class, they are totally different. So a teacher will be like, no, they were not like that before you walked in. And it's because many of these kids know that I honestly really do go the extra mile for them. And I make sure I put incentives in place. If I promise them that if you have a good day, yesterday I had to promise this kid, he saw me with a cup of coffee, and he said, okay, you're going to have to give me some hot chocolate. And I'm like, okay, if you have a good day, all your teachers tell me you did well, I'll get you a cup of hot chocolate. And you got to really make those kind of incentives because some kids are just emotional learners, and you have to figure out how to accommodate them wherever they are.
In figuring out how to accommodate them wherever they are,
yeah,
you talk about helping the child to set goals. Mm-hmm. I would think for some of these children, the idea of, you know, setting a goal, the goal may be to live through today. So what kind of goals are you working with these children around?
So it depends on the demographic. So the kids that are more street involved, it may be coming home at a decent hour 1 to 2 days a week. I like to start small because a lot of people want to see significant change overnight. And I often talk about it took years for these kids to develop these kind of behaviors, years of trauma and years of not having the support and nurture that they needed. So it's going to take years to reteach these young people. So if they are coming home every night at 2 a.m. and they're not consistent, they're not going to school, if you start going to school, if you was at zero and now you're at 2 days a week, I'm celebrating you. Let's set that as a goal. All right, so you're at 2 days, let's go to 3 days. All right, you're at 3 days, let's go to 4 days. So small steps, and those are goals that they need to start with. Let's not, you know, if they're not in school at all, let's not shoot for the rocket in the sky. So let's actually, you know, not even look at college per se right now. Let's just finish this week. You know, so as you said, they just need to get through the day. Sometimes we need to just look at the day. All right, you have a ninth period class today, and it's a class that you typically aren't doing well in. I want you to go in there and take some notes. That's the goal for the day. And just making sure that you have realistic goals for them, because goals can be intimidating for all of us. So if they aren't realistic, a student will look at it and see it as unachievable. But if we say, okay, even kids that smoke weed, I'm not looking for you to stop all at once because I know it's an addiction. And with that in mind, okay, you're smoking 5 to 6 blunts a day. All right, do me a favor. I want you to be honest with me. And that's another thing that we have to ensure that we teach our kids, that they can be transparent and vulnerable to us because we have their best interest in mind. So, okay, you're smoking 4 to 5, 6 blunts a day. All right, let's go down to 3. Let's go down. Okay, how did you do today? Oh, I messed up. I did 4. All right, so tomorrow, let's do 3. All right, and then next week, let's move it to 2. And then we eventually, gradually teach our young people how to become better by setting realistic goals.
Helping your children, helping these children to set realistic goals, I think what you're also doing is you're growing an adult who has an increasing ability to plan, to be reflective, to set his or her own goals, and then to actually come up with ways to meet those goals and go beyond that. So it really, you may be teaching a 10 or a 12-year-old or a 15-year-old, but that learning carries them throughout their lives.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It teaches them how to be good, responsible citizens as they mature into young men and young women, because life is full of goals. And in order to be successful, you have to make it through each day, and each day has to become greater each week, each month, each year. And I think it gives them the ambition to understand how to work towards something that's better than where I am currently.
The book that you have written, Painting Pictures, Reframing the World of Inner City Youth, it's gotten some pretty positive press. Were you surprised about that?
Very happy, very excited about it. And definitely, I don't know if I want to say surprised, because I do feel like it's a message that needs to be conveyed to a lot of people. So I was just very pleased that it received the press that it has. Yes.
Do you share your book with some of the children you are mentoring, or do you routinely share it with the parents, or?
Yeah. So I have shared it on some level with most of everyone that I have dealt with. And it may not be a physical copy. It just may be me giving some knowledge from the book. Just yesterday, like I said, in that session with one of the mentors when he was ready to give up, I had to start quoting items from my book. Like, this is why you don't give up. So I do enjoy sharing the book to young people, to mentors, and to parents to help them understand that this is a battle that we're all fighting. And in order for our young people to be successful, we have to paint pictures for them, because all they know is what they do. And if they don't know any better, they can't do any better.
Corey, how does one get more information about painting pictures?
So absolutely. You can go on my website, which is paintingpicturesinc.org.
The work that you're doing, it just seems like such critical work. So I am probably joining a chorus of people in thanking you for the work that you do and the work that I know that you will continue to do.
Absolutely. Thank you so very much.
All right. Well, thank you again, Corey D. James, author of Painting Pictures, Reframing the World of Inner City Youth, and founder and CEO of Painting Pictures, Inc., which is a nonprofit organization dedicated to making an impact in the lives of disadvantaged youth. Thank you, Corey, very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to take the place of any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available to you on demand at myndtalk.org. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, you can always send an email to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. And folks, I want you to remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. Take care.